88.9 FM KUCI, it's The Docket. I'm Evan Simon. Welcome to the program, everybody. 8245-824-949 UCI, KUCI. That is my telephone number and the phone number to call to donate to the KUCI Fund Drive. We are at the nearing the end of our fund drive, but we still need your support to keep KUCI and its public affairs programming on the air. We offer you programming you cannot hear anywhere else. And today on the program, we're going to talk about a subject which, although it gets quite a bit of attention, we're going to talk about an aspect of it that really does not get much attention at all. We're talking about immigration law. In fact, you may have heard a few weeks ago the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on SB 1070, the Arizona law known as the Show Me Your Papers law. Oral argument was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court on April 25th, 2012 in Washington, D.C. The law is expected to shape the development of immigration policies and redraw the boundaries to the immigration law enforcement. But we're going to talk in depth today about the immigration system. And we're going to hear stories from the immigration system, from the immigration courts, that are not reported. Why? Well, that perhaps is anybody's guess, but the fact remains that a lot of people just don't know and don't understand about the way our immigration system works, the way our immigration courts work. We, as Americans, believe in due process, in liberty, in justice, and all that. But according to my guest today, who's joining me in studio, Peter Afra-Siabi, tells us that in his new book, Show Trials, How Property Gets More Legal Protection Than People in Our Failed Immigration System, the immigration courts don't play by the same rule book that we're accustomed to here in America. So, Peter Afra-Siabi, thank you so much for joining me in the studio to talk about the immigration system. It's a subject that actually we've not talked about on this show very much. And the system itself, we hear in the political discourse about overhauls of the system, especially when a politician comes up with some big grand proposal. And we'll often hear about the immigration system in the context of so-called illegal immigration. But the daily mechanics of the immigration system is something that there's not a whole lot of explanation about. There's really not, at least in the media, much of an exploration of the nitty-gritty of the immigration system, right?
That's right, Evan. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
You know, the macro policy issues of immigration are well debated, well discussed at local, state, federal levels. But the actual court system that processes 300,000-400,000 cases a year for non-citizens seeking to stay and stop their deportation so they may adjust their status, that court system is something that doesn't get a lot of attention outside of legal academia. And that's the reason for the book.
It's Show Trials, How Property Gets More Legal Protection Than People in Our Failed Immigration System. You make this comparison between people and property, in part because you have some experience in both realms. You are an intellectual property attorney.
Correct. I have one foot really in each of these worlds. I spend most of my time as an intellectual property lawyer fighting copyright, trademark, right of publicity, entertainment type disputes. And these are disputes that occur in our federal courts primarily, sometimes our state courts, and they're courts which, for shorthand, we can refer to as property courts, and they handle and decide property disputes. And we have a very, very robust system that's been built over time and that's very strong and very robust in terms of ensuring that we have due process so that property rights can be adjudicated and processed in a system that's as fair as is possible. The same system that also addresses criminal cases where you have life and liberty questions. Now, in my, private practice component that focuses on pro bono efforts, and in my class I've taught at now at UCI's law school and previously at the Chapman Law School, I have taken over many, many years many immigration appeals, and I've also done them privately myself just as a pro bono part of our pro bono practice as lawyers that we really are obligated to do. And in that court system, I have spent many, many years fighting many, many cases. And you see a system that's not built with the same architecture that our property court system has been built with. And so you can get disparate outcomes and disparate results when you start looking at these two systems from a inter-system point of view. And it is, you know, the point of pivot really is what we do in property court versus what we do in immigration court. And as you look at the different constituents of the system, you very quickly can isolate and see that the same concerns of due process that we take very, very seriously in our other courts, we do not take seriously in our immigration courts.
All right. Well, you call them the Article III courts, property courts, but I've actually never heard that term, property courts, because Article III courts do more than just adjudicate property, although certainly that's a huge component. You mentioned criminal aspects that get heard in Article III courts, right? So it's not just property.
Correct. It's for shorthand, we can refer to them as property courts, really, because the point of comparison is what's going on in the immigration system versus what goes on in our federal and state courts.
Right.
You know, and part of the confusion that can come for non-lawyers is that the immigration courts are part of the federal government. So I didn't want to subsume them under the concept of federal courts because they're actually not part of the judicial branch of the Constitution. They're part of the executive branch of the federal government.
Right. And that actually leads to my next question. Why are there separate courts for immigration disputes?
Sure. You know, immigration has not been placed within the realm of the judicial branch. Instead, as immigration law has developed from Congress, ultimately from the body politic, the electorate, the people, it has been something that belongs to the executive, and the executive has been given the authority to create the court system and essentially build this court system by a set of rules. And that court system has not been divorced from the executive in a way that you would want when a court system is to address constitutional questions, you know, people's constitutional liberty interests in avoiding unfair, wrongful deportations. But those questions have not been divorced from the executive system. We as a society have been able to divorce many of our executive-type questions from the executive branch. For example, you know, bankruptcy is one example where you have different courts that have been divorced from the political tethers that, you know, the immigration court possesses. And you have even other courts like Social Security, which is certainly something within the province of the executive. But those courts have also been further removed from the executive. And one of the problems the book focuses on is that immigration is a very, very political issue, obviously. It's a divisive issue in this country. But if you have people who have constitutional rights at stake, they more than anything, and we more than anything as a system, need to make sure that those cases can be adjudicated as an impartial forum as is possible, really.
You know, what are those constitutional rights at stake? Life, liberty, is that getting close?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's it. It's life and liberty questions. And really, the starting point in the analysis is to look at some Supreme Court cases from a century ago where immigrants would arrive in America and would be subject to, sometimes a quick deportation. Sometimes there'd be a deportation that occurred 20 years later when they had a citizen spouse or citizen children. And the Supreme Court, in assessing the adequacy of the process that was employed, made clear that their interests at stake are of a constitutional dimension. And so they have a liberty interest, if they've been here for a long time, in not having their life torn apart and disrupted. When you're talking about people seeking political asylum, you can be talking about not just liberty interests to avoid being deported to a despotic regime, but potentially even life interests if that regime may torture or kill them.
8245-824-949 UCI, KUCI. I'm Evan Simon. Speaking with Peter Afrasiabi. He is an attorney who wrote a book, Show Trials, How Property Gets More Legal Protection Than People in Our Failed Immigration System. A bit of an indictment of the immigration system. Now, Peter, I want to ask you about, in your ideal world, what are the goals of the immigration system? What should the focus of immigration policy be here in the United States? I don't want to get too political, but, you know, politics, one definition of politics is the allocation of scarce resources. And certainly the notion that, we can't have everybody in this country, right? So there has to be some rules about who gets in and who doesn't get in if they're not born here. Is that fair to say?
It's certainly fair for the American people to decide that we're not going to have an open border and we want to have some set of rules by which we will allow people to legalize and secure status here. you know, the American people ultimately through Congress get to define what those rules are.
Right.
The focus of the book becomes, if we're going to have a set of rules, which we have created and which were created over time, at a minimum, we need to make sure those rules are employed fairly and properly, and they're not in the current system. And more fundamentally, at a higher policy level, what has happened over time has been a constriction of even those limited rights that people were given, to the point that there's been even some suffocation in the system, such that, for example, you know, in certain cases, there's no right of appeal even to a neutral Article III federal court. And that is something that is very, very troubling. It's something that I think the average American doesn't realize from their perceptions and understanding of court systems, that, for example, people could be denied a right of appeal to a neutral court. It's unheard of in our property realm. And that's sort of, you know, in one area of my practice, I do some patent litigation, and we often go to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals for our patent appeals. And that's a court system that's singularly devoted to patents. And it's a fantastic court with a set of fantastic judges that spend their time making sure that we get the balance between competition and monopoly and patent rights and patent policy set properly so that business can operate efficiently. The same right, though, for people who are facing a deportation has been stripped from them in recent years.
So you said a lot there, and my eyes are kind of popping out, because the notion that you don't get a right to appeal if you have a deportation order and you feel that you were wronged or that the judge was not acting impartially.
Correct. You know, it's not in every case, but it's in a broad array of cases. And there are cases that come under a set of laws known primarily as cancellation of removal, although there's a whole host of laws for which the right to appeal to a federal court has been denied. But we can focus on a massive case, a set of cases, and that would be these cancellation of removal. And ultimately, cancellation of removal is a set of social policies that were, you know, first enacted 60, 70 years ago, precisely because there was a barrage of deportations that our policymakers of the time said were unjust and un-American. And they were very, very concerned that we were deporting people who had been here for 20, 30 years. They had citizen children. Families were getting torn apart. And so they created the system. That same system has been sort of built over time, and then it's been dismantled. But the linchpin of the system is, you know, people have the right to stop a deportation if they've been here for 10 years continuously. They have good moral character. They don't have a criminal background, and they can show that they have, you know, a citizen child or a citizen spouse for whom the deportation to a foreign country would impose an extreme hardship. Now, when an immigration judge looks at a fact pattern and says, yeah, I don't think that would impose hardship, and that this happens all the time, that decision is no longer appealable outside of this politicized immigration court context. You can't take that up to the federal courts of appeals and get a neutral review from at least one set of appellate judges who can assess whether that was an appropriate decision, an inappropriate decision. Was it the product of flawed, you know, decision-making, flawed thinking? And so those decisions become insulated.
I'm assuming there are factors in determining when hardship exists.
You know, it's a very, you know, unfortunately, it's a very loose and ill-defined test. There's only been, you know, two published decisions from the Intermediate Immigration Appellate Body within the Executive Office of Immigration Review that even articulate exactly when someone can get it and when they can't. And when you study the sort of the body of law in this area, you find inconsistencies all over the place. So, for example, one of the cases profiled in my book deals with family that had been here for 20 years. They've been paying tax. They have one child who was brought here when she was about a year old. They have other children that were born here, 3, 4 U.S. citizen children. The kids now range in age, you know, from, you know, 5 up to, you know, junior high school. And they go to the court and show that this would impose an extreme hardship on them if deported, and their kids have medical issues. One of them needed medical care in the United States. They even got testimony from the principal of the school, for example, and the psychologist from the school district who said deporting these children will impose an undue hardship on them. But the immigration judge, because these decisions are ultimately unreviewable, is able to sort of just disagree and said, I disagree. I don't think this will impose an atypical hardship, because the hardship these children will experience leaving their communities or towns or homelands is no different to any other hardship that anyone would experience if they got deported. And so in that sense, it's not unusual. And so they're denied relief. And I've taken these cases up to the federal courts of appeal trying to find a way to get appellate review of these decisions so that we can focus in on the constitutional rights to preserve family integrity and the familial unity. And those arguments are precluded from being made at this point because Congress has eliminated judicial review. And that's the one of the fundamental problems in the system.
824-5824-949-UCI-KUCI. We're speaking with Peter Afrasiabi of One LLP talking about his book Show Trials and the immigration system. One of the things that came up during the presidential campaign, at least in the Republican primaries, was the notion of anchor babies, where people come to this country, perhaps illegally, they have children, and then are here to stay in some sense. Is that a phenomenon that deserves public concern?
No, it's not. It's more the politics of immigration and the politics of scare tactics and fear, I think. The reality is that it has never been the case that someone can just cross the border, pop out a baby, and say, now I'm here, give me, welfare, social benefits, and, the parade of everything that's wonderful about being an American. That's never been the law. The law has always been focused on, for those types of cases, either political asylum as a path to legalization or having spent a significant amount of time here such that the qualifying relative, such as a child, has actually acclimated to American culture and American society, and it would pose a hardship. So you simply don't have this phenomenon of people racing across the border to try to give birth to get the benefits of American citizenship because it's just never been given out in that way. And so what we've seen instead is that people who really do need the benefits of these laws, who have, like the example I gave, of citizen children who don't even necessarily speak the language of the country they're being deported to sometimes, which is pretty staggering to think that we would send them back there as U.S. citizens. They have lost even the right to get really a neutral court review of this because of the politics of immigration and that kind of imagery that's been created.
Yeah. Well, let's, from a broad view here, what are the paths to legalization?
There is, of course, the path that's available to highly educated, highly skilled workers from around the world where you have sort of a visa allotment system. And that's one path. And that's the path that you often hear about when you hear about the politics of immigration and the issues raised about people should wait in line like everyone else. And we can talk about that.
Yeah.
Another path, obviously, is people who've suffered, persecution on account of a protected ground under the asylum laws, and they're entitled to political asylum. And those are cases that get heard in the immigration court system, cases that I've dealt with. And the other set of cases that I've dealt with are these sort of cancellation of removal or what we can call hardship cases. Those are the primary mechanisms by which someone sitting outside the United States has the right to ultimately enter and ultimately stay and remain in the United States.
All right, so political asylum, visa allotment, and the waiting list, and cancellation of removal. Those are the main three paths that people can enter and stay in the United States as citizens.
Sure, in broad strokes, yeah.
Okay. Well, on the political asylum side, where are the problems that you see with that realm of cases?
Sure. So the problems really inhabit all corners of the current immigration court system because these are cases that necessarily involve people trying to avoid being returned to a foreign country where they could be persecuted or tortured for all sorts of reasons, from their sexual orientation to their gender to their religion to their race, their ethnicity, a whole panoply of reasons. And our law specifically says if they have a well-founded fear of persecution, if being returned to a foreign country, then their deportation should not occur. Now, those cases which seek to ensure that these liberty interests of people be adjudicated properly are not heard in our neutral courts, nor are they even heard in administrative courts divorced from the executive. Instead, they're heard in the immigration court system, which is what the book details. And that system then starts with the judges who, when you look at data as a means to explore who the immigration judges are and how they become judges, and you compare them to our neutral Article III court judges, you see there's a massive disparity in terms of, background, experience, qualifications to be a judge. And so we start sort of from the wrong starting point to begin with when we have the potentially the wrong group of people addressing the questions of these immigrants who are looking for political asylum. And then when we look at the lawyers involved in these cases, we see other problems. You know, first and foremost, on the side of the immigrant, there's not even a right to an attorney that will be provided to make sure that the process can unfold fairly. So 60% of the time in you know, the deportation cases every year, you have people who are not represented by attorneys. Now, on the other side, you have government attorneys who are well-paid and very, very talented lawyers and very, very good lawyers who are, you know, not subject, for example, to sanctions if they behave inappropriately by the immigration court judges, whereas privately hired immigration lawyers, for example, are subject to sanctions. So you have a sort of a break in the playing field, and the book focuses on, you know, some sets of cases looking at the government lawyers and how they pursue victory in their cases, which doesn't really align to the goal of pursuing justice always. And we also look in another section at the private immigration bar and the problems that it faces in terms of being overworked, underpaid, and unfortunately, compared to, for example, our property court lawyers, you know, failing their clients at a disproportionate rate.
Yeah, I've heard a number of stories of people who have come to this country and have hired private immigration lawyers, and I'm not quite sure exactly what they do wrong, but I'm told of the stories that they do something wrong, or they are completely just swindled out of money, and they do absolutely nothing for their clients, and the clients are the ones who have to pay the price.
That's right. You know, there's a lot of cases detailed in my book, and there's a lot more cases that stand behind it that I just don't have enough pages to fill, where you see malfeasance of immigration lawyers taking its toll on the immigrants, and it's a cause and a function of many different factors. One of which is simply the case that they're underpaid and overworked, and you know, even though people are here seeking political asylum sometimes, and their liberty and life interests mean a lot to them, it doesn't mean they have a lot of money necessarily to pay for a lawyer. In fact, often they don't, and so you have lawyers taking too many cases. You have the problem of immigration judges inculcating an atmosphere sometimes that permits egregious malfeasance. One of the examples I gave is a young boy who came from Peru whose parents secured political asylum, but the 13-year-old boy was denied political asylum when the parents were granted it and was told you have to deport by your 14, otherwise you'll be in violation of criminal laws at that point.
Why?
Well, the immigration judge just got it wrong, and the parents had come earlier than the boy, so they had managed to sort of be here for the requisite number of time. The boy hadn't, and rather than the lawyer focusing the judge on the fact that these headwinds don't make any sense, that we could be allowing this boy's parents to stay in the United States but would be ordering a 13-year-old to deport, the lawyer dropped the ball, and this was a lawyer who was subsequently disbarred for his malfeasance in the immigration community. We have a government lawyer on the other side who didn't say justice, which the Department of Justice is obligated to swear to as opposed to victory, but that justice doesn't really makes sense if we're deporting this child. And we had an immigration judge who allowed it to happen. And so then this boy later on went to a notario, and we can talk about notarios, but then he ended up eventually with a second lawyer, and the second lawyer tried to undo the errors of the first lawyer, but the second lawyer himself was disbarred for malfeasance upon immigrants, and he didn't do a good enough job of pointing out the errors of the first lawyer. So you had this poor boy who at this point was a man who was caught in this, you know, impossible loop where both lawyers he had hired ended up being disbarred. And so ultimately in his case, the immigration judge said, well, your lawyers are not obligated to look for every possible form of relief for you. So it's too bad. It's your responsibility. You should have come back to court sooner. You should have done this. You should have done that, even though he was a child. And so the immigration lawyers have been allowed to get away with things that I, in my private practice, in my property cases, could never get away with. I'd be sued for malpractice, or I could even, you know, be subject to rebuke and admonishment by the court. But the same headwinds don't exist in the immigration court system as a means to patrol and guard the bar, unfortunately.
All right, Peter, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to dig in more to some of the stories that you talk about in your book. And we'll also talk about the Supreme Court case that was heard involving the Arizona law, and how the arguments shaped up and how that case is shaping up. 824-5824-949 UCI, KUCI. I'm Evan Simon. It's The Docket on KUCI, KUCI.org. Stay close.
See, la 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 la